Hello and welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. I'm Viv Davies from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. It's the 21st of September 2012, and I'm talking with Christopher Sims, Nobel Laureate and Professor of Economics and Banking at Princeton University. We met at a meeting of the Euro Area Business Cycle Network in Brussels, where Professor Sims presented his ideas on what he referred to as a least unlikely path to a sustainable EMU. I began the interview by asking Chris to explain what he described in his presentation as being the long-term direction of institutional restructuring that would be required to put the Eurozone on the path to a sustainable recovery.
If you look at objective measures of the fiscal situation in the US and Japan, they look worse than, or the UK for that matter, they look worse than such objective measures for the Eurozone as a whole, or even for most of the southern tier countries. Debt to GDP ratios, deficit to GDP ratios are in dangerous territory in Japan and the US, and yet neither of those countries, and the same is true of the UK, are paying anywhere near the premium for default risk that the southern tier European countries are paying. My view is that reflects institutional structure that is common across the UK, Japan, and the US that's missing in the euro area. The other three countries all have a central bank that corresponds to a single treasury. The single treasury issues nominal debt, and it answers to a legislature that's a national legislature. So this has several consequences. One is that the lender of last resort function is much firmer in the US, the UK, and Japan, because a lender of last resort has to be an institution with deep pockets that can lend and itself be subject to very little or no worry about default risk. So at a time when liquidity dries up because everybody begins to feel that every counterparty might have substantial default risk, a big institution that can come in and lend to people who are unable to get credit can resolve the situation. This has happened historically many times. It used to be that sometimes large private banks that were large on a national scale could perform this function. But even a large private bank can be subject to default risk itself, so in a big enough crisis can't act. Whereas a central bank that can, if necessary, be recapitalized by a legislature that issues nominal government debt has essentially unlimited pockets. Its debt issue involves no commitment to provide anything except paper. And so nobody will have doubts about whether it's going to default on the debt it issues. Of course, if the legislature and treasury are in a position where they might run deficits forever, then the nominal debt can become worthless. It can get inflated away. But that's not the situation in Europe now. Europe is not having a crisis because people think it can never run primary surpluses again. It's having a crisis because the southern tier countries have promised to pay not paper they can issue, but euros that they can't issue on their own. And there's a real possibility that they may not be able to raise the euros that they have promised. That's the issue. So in going into the euro area, the euro countries, the EMU countries, have given up this possibility of having a national lender of last resort that's as effective as those in the UK, the US, and Japan. And the ECB, in its original formulation, was supposed to never be a lender of last resort. But in the crisis we've seen, Europe, like other large advanced economies, needs a sound lender of last resort. And in order for that to happen, there has to be some kind of institutional mechanism that reflects political consensus that there can be such a thing as a euro area level fiscal commitment. There has to be a recognition by financial markets that at the level of the euro, there can be decisions to pay returns on assets and to issue debt that is backed by a euro area commitment. And so far, that hasn't happened because there's so much concern in the euro area about one country or group of countries being ripped off by other countries or groups of countries in any arrangement that actually involves shared fiscal commitments. So at some length, I guess that's what I think is the fundamental problem in the euro area, that finding ways to construct institutions that convince markets that there is such a thing as a shared fiscal commitment at the euro level.
So you'd be in favor of eurobonds?
Yes, some form of eurobonds. You don't want to think of all countries' debts being made into eurobonds, and I don't think you want to, you don't even have to have eurobonds being most of the European area debt. Countries ought to be mostly issuing debt that's their own obligation. They should be able to default on that debt. Default premia on country debt should be possible. But you could have eurobonds, since European level government organizations don't have very big budgets. The eurobonds might come into existence through an agency that bought sovereign debt of individual countries and used eurobond issue to finance that. Of course, such an agency would be making political decisions, and it would need careful consideration of what kind of democratic backing to give such an agency. But what we're having now is, in emergency after emergency, the ECB is moving closer and closer to being such an agency itself. And that necessarily weakens its independence as a central bank. It becomes involved in essentially political decisions, and the structure of that institution is not that of an agency that's making political decisions. It's meant to be a central bank with a narrow objective, that with mainly technical problem of keeping inflation stable. It's not meant to be making controversial judgments about which country's debt should be supported in value because markets have an exaggerated idea of default risk, versus which country's debts actually are insolvent and need to be at least partially defaulted. But that's what it's having to do in the current situation.
So you see that a natural progression maybe is towards a more federal Europe?
Yes, though right now the analogy with the U.S. is certainly incomplete. U.S. state government budgets are non-trivial relative to the federal government budget, but their debts are small relative to federal government debt. Whereas in Europe, the central government's budget is tiny relative to country budgets, and some of the individual countries have debts that are a substantial fraction of EU GDP, whereas that's not really true of U.S. states. Nonetheless, I think a movement in the direction of federal Europe, banking union, some form of eurobond, are the only way to provide a sustainable euro monetary unit.
So you wrote somewhat of a prophetic paper in, I think, 1999, outlining the challenges that would face the EMU. Could you give us a little explanation of that, perhaps?
That paper was called The Precarious Fiscal Foundations of EMU, and it was written from the perspective of the fiscal theory of the price level, which I had worked on before. Most of the models in that strand of literature had worked with single-country models. But when you thought about the EMU from the perspective of these models, you saw two things. One is, so long as those country debts were euro debt and all equivalent, and the central bank was controlling the interest rate on government debt, that there would be a free rider problem, that a single country wouldn't face directly any consequences from issuing steadily growing debt. And in effect, what would happen if it did that would be that if the price level remained stable, it would remain stable through other countries running steady surpluses that offset the steady deficits of the free-riding countries. And I argued that that wouldn't be sustainable, so that there would be a necessity for some kind of fiscal discipline or control. This was assuming the ECB did what it essentially did, which was treat all kinds of sovereign debt of European countries as essentially equivalent in its monetary operations. At the beginning, it managed to keep interest rates constant across countries for all practical purposes. So the debts were equivalent. You could think of the ECB as controlling the interest rate, was an interest rate on safe securities. Safe securities were euro area government debt. But if it was going to do that, there had to be some kind of fiscal backstop, and I argued that what was in the Maastricht Treaty, which were penalties for countries that violated these fixed limits on deficit to GDP or debt to GDP ratios, were not credible. Because my view was then, and still is, that the way countries get into a situation where they are violating these such limits is something really bad happens to their economy. And it didn't seem to me credible that something really bad would happen to one country and the other countries would then come and say, okay, you have to pay a fine. And in fact, we see that exactly this is how it worked, that there were such penalties supposedly, but the first countries to violate the limits were not penalized because everybody could see they had a good excuse. And my feeling is that attempting to create fiscal discipline by punishments just was not going to work. And I think that so long as everybody's issuing debt denominated in euros, there's a common currency, one has to admit that there is a possibility of country-level default and that it can occur without exit from the euro. And I think at the beginning of the crisis, the ECB was thinking of monetary policy in the traditional way and was thinking that there is no provision for default or exit from the euro, so that it had to act on the assumption that default was impossible. And that's part of why we've gotten to the difficulty we have. There should be a euro bond, a common fiscal commitment, and at the same time an admission that country-level default is possible.
That's a great summary. Christopher Sims, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us today.
You're welcome. I've enjoyed it.